I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. An editorial in yesterday's New York Times was titled President Bannon, and it begins, Mr. Bannon supercharged Breitbart News as a platform for inciting the alt-right, and he did the same with the Trump campaign. He's now repeating the act with the Trump White House itself. The new executive order politicizing the process for national security decisions suggests Mr. Bannon is positioning himself not merely as a Svengali, but as the de facto president. So we thought it would be worth our while to learn more about Steve Bannon, his life, and the influence that he now has in the Trump administration. We have two guests this hour. Scott Shane will start the hour from the New York Times. He wrote a piece at the end of November, Combative Populist Steve Bannon Found His Man in Donald Trump. He writes to understand what to expect from the Trump administration means in part to fathom the driven, contradictory character of Mr. Bannon, whom the president-elect has named senior counselor and chief White House strategist. And later, Kate Brennan, who writes, if there was any question about who is largely in charge of national security behind the scene at the White House, the answer is becoming increasingly clear. It is Steve Bannon. Scott Shane with us first, covering national security and terrorism for the New York Times for a number of years. His reporting on U.S. interrogation techniques and torture put him and his colleagues as a finalist for the Pulitzer in 2007. He worked for the Baltimore Sun before the Times. He's also the author of a new book titled Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. And he wrote a great profile of Steve Bannon for the Times back in November, which we will put on our Facebook page because it's worth reading. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Our phone number, I'm sure we'll have many calls this hour, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Scott, thanks very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Happy to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. It was a really informative article, and we need to know more about him now more than ever before. Let's go to the 2004 film that you write about, In the Face of Evil, a film about Ronald Reagan put together by Steve Bannon, which you say has a prophetic ring to it. How so?
So, first, it might be worth knowing that Steve Bannon served in the Navy, then went to Harvard Business School, became an investment banker with Goldman Sachs, and then sort of through learning about media investments sort of segued into being a film producer. And so in 2004, he produced and wrote a film about Ronald Reagan called In the Face of Evil. And what was interesting, I talked to several other people who worked with him on that film, is that the 9/11 attacks came along when the film was already sort of in the works. And his colleagues said that radically changed the film because Bannon wanted to sort of connect Reagan and his sort of face-off with communism with more contemporary affairs and the United States and its face-off against Al-Qaeda. So the film, the reason it's striking, was striking to me, is that it presents Reagan as both the sort of savior of the American working class, but also as a strong leader who can take on this global enemy of communism.
Mm-hmm.
And it even uses language like, he was the only one who could do this, who could take on this challenge. And, of course, it immediately brought to mind Donald Trump saying repeatedly on the campaign trail things like, I'm the only one who can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was a bond that formed between Bannon and Trump, and now we're seeing the result.
He had earlier, though, pressed, you write, Lou Dobbs to run for office. He flirted with other presidential hopefuls, Rick Santorum, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, but found something lacking in those candidates?
Well, I mean, it's certainly my impression that he was looking for, this was a guy who was sort of brimming over with ambition and ideas, and he was looking for a candidate to get behind. And so he was sort of experimenting with these different candidates. He made films about Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann as well. And so, but I think he was always attracted to Trump. And in fact, Steve Bannon, as the head of Breitbart News, had a regular radio show on Sirius on satellite radio, and he had on that show as a guest Donald Trump on multiple occasions. And if you listen to those tapes now, those recordings now, you hear them bonding, and you actually hear, in a way, Bannon almost in a respectful way becoming a sort of tutor to Trump, sort of explaining the, you know, some of the nuances of issues, and even when he thinks Trump may be putting his foot wrong, you know, sort of gently correcting him or leading him to a slightly different point of view. So I think that was one, you know, one of the ways in which they sort of connected. And then, you know, and then he clearly took a real interest in the campaign and spotted Trump's potential when most of the media were, you know, essentially writing Donald Trump off as a sideshow.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting is he has these, well, he's more parts to him than this, but this, when you read his comments about what's happened to the middle class and how many people were ripped off during the economic crisis and the elites in Wall Street and how they never were punished and should have been punished, he almost sounds like he's espousing rhetoric from Bernie Sanders. And yet when you look at the other rhetoric, which is equally strong, it almost sounds like he's ready to engage in a war with Islam.
Yeah, that's what I meant in writing that he was a contradictory character. I guess the first contradiction that strikes you is, here's a guy who worked for Goldman Sachs and went to Harvard Business School, made a ton of money. In fact, he happened to acquire a share of the Seinfeld reruns before Seinfeld was, you know, such a big hit. And I think that that's given him lots and lots of money. So he was moving in those kind of elite circles, including in Hollywood. And yet, in recent years, certainly, he has fashioned himself as an avowed opponent of elites, the political elite and the economic elite. And he's repeatedly said that essentially the political elite has sort of made deals at the expense of the working class.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, I mean, there were excerpts from some of his speeches that I listened to that really could have been, I think easily the same words could have been spoken by Bernie Sanders. But if you get into other areas like immigration, Islam, you know, he's a very, very different voice from Sanders and the left. He has said for some years that we, you know, whether we know it or not, we're in a global war with Islam, with radical Islam. But sometimes he simplifies it to Islam and refers all the way back to the sort of great battles between Christians and Muslims going back to the Crusades. So he sees things in these sort of apocalyptic terms, and he's been extremely hostile to immigration, in part because he thinks that it serves these business elites to bring in cheap labor, and that the people who suffer are the American working class.
Is he a deeply religious man?
You know, it's my impression that he's not a deeply religious man, but he certainly had a religious upbringing. He was the son of a guy who was a telephone lineman and then eventually got into sort of middle management at the phone company in Richmond, Virginia. And there he went to a conservative Catholic all-boys military high school. And he does, you know, he's very consciously a conservative Catholic, and he talks about Christianity, you know, certainly as sort of part of his worldview. So in that sense, I think that does inform his notion of the Judeo-Christian world facing off against radical Islam, as he's often talked about.
Mm-hmm. People describe him as smart. He's a reader. He knows history.
Yeah, he does a lot of reading. He drops the names of, you know, Plutarch and Plato, and I don't think it's an act. I think he's in that sense he's very intellectual, but at the same time, he's kind of a bomb thrower, revolutionary, an anarchist almost. Certainly he likes, you know, a guy he worked with on a film said that, you know, when they were cutting in the process, which is often very painful, of cutting a documentary, and Bannon was, you know, didn't want to cut it anymore, and they got in a little bit of an argument, and Bannon turned the table, literally turned the table over, and this guy said, Steve likes to turn everything into a fight. And when you look at this executive order that President Trump signed last Friday on immigration, banning visitors for 90 days from 7 Muslim countries and banning refugees for 120 days and so on, as everybody knows, that set off, you know, quite a firestorm. And people have said it was incompetently carried out and it could have been done much more smoothly. But, you know, and I don't know this for a fact, but we've been told that Bannon was sort of the driving force behind that order and its timing. And I think he welcomes this kind of a reaction. You know, he told one of my colleagues last week that the media are the opposition party. He wants the criticism. It rallies the base. It stirs things up. It sort of breaks up the conventions of Washington, and so on a grand scale now he's sort of turning the table over once again.
Mm-hmm. And what does he see in Donald Trump? And what does Donald Trump see in him?
I think that he sees in Mr. Trump a guy with a real sort of visceral talent for which we saw in spades during the campaign for rallying the sort of disaffected working class, disaffected middle class, mainly the white working class and middle class, and bringing them to their feet, making them real believers in, you know, people who are maybe disillusioned with politics, getting very excited about politics. So I think he sees Trump's skills as a politician and also a little bit as a showman. I mean, Bannon, you know, worked in Hollywood for some time and made these films. Trump was, of course, on The Apprentice, so they have that in common. And I think, you know, I think he admires the fact that Trump began the campaign, it seemed almost as a kind of joke, vanquished 16 Republican candidates and defeated the Democratic candidate nominee who was supposed to be a shoo-in. I mean, you know, he sort of hitched his wagon to hitched himself to quite a sort of rocket, as it turns out. What Trump sees in Bannon is an interesting question. I mean, Trump is, you know, not a detail guy, not a policy guy.
Mm-hmm.
He needs somebody to explain all this stuff to him, and Bannon is very well informed. He's a voracious reader. He works very hard. I can only assume that President Trump relies on Bannon to sort of brief him on a lot of these things and advise him on a lot of the issues that he's suddenly faced with making decisions about.
He's been called Bannon a racist, a sexist, anti-Semite, Islamophobe. Is that a fair description of him? And also, he was head of a news organization that could easily be accused of all of those and then some. So two questions. Is that, do those give us his views? And two, why would he become head of an organization that is filled with those kinds of sentiments?
Well, I mean, I guess you have to distinguish between his personal views and personal conduct and his sort of political tactics and worldview. I talked to people who've known him for years and know him very well, and I think I can say that he's not an anti-Semite. He's not particularly biased against other races in his personal life. But I think he, at Breitbart and in the campaign, was very much an opportunist in the sense that he was quite willing to stir up those kinds of passions and take advantage of them. He had, and the same can be said to some degree of his boss as well, President Trump. You know, but certainly Bannon had opportunities to denounce or separate himself from some of the more extreme voices that, you know, kind of rallied around Breitbart, and he didn't take that step because I think he saw it as profitable in the sense of building Breitbart's audience and then subsequently in the sense of when he took over Donald Trump's campaign and in the sense of, you know, building a bigger voter base to welcome everybody who had an interest, including, you know, the most despicable racist, sexist, Islamophobic types. I mean, I think the only place where Steve Bannon himself has said things about other people that were, you know, that many people would find offensive would be, he had said some things about women on occasion that, and feminists, you know, that, right, that I think people would find offensive. And he's, you know, he's very critical of Islam and Muslims. And he's, I think, fair to say, very anti-immigrant or at least, you know, against letting immigrants into this country.
Scott Chain is our guest. He has been covering national security terrorism for the New York Times since 2004. We wanted to do a show on Steve Bannon, his influence in the current administration, and to refresh our memories a little bit more about who he is. Scott wrote a piece at the end of November, Combative Populist Steve Bannon Found His Man in Donald Trump. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where you can find his article, and we're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Starting our calls for Scott with Pat in Mazamani. Hi, Pat.
Good afternoon. I just have a couple of comments, and they're making me quite frustrated. the first is that I think I've heard two shows now, yours, Kathleen, and also On Point, discuss Steve Bannon and being on a strategic planning group. And neither of those shows, even though they admit that he received a master's in administration from Harvard University with honors, they don't talk about the fact that he also has a master's degree in National Security Studies from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, nor that he was a special assistant to the Chief of Naval Operations at the Pentagon. And it seems like those are two qualifications that lead to me wondering if there are partial truths being given in some of these commentaries.
What do you mean partial truths, Pat?
Well, because we never hear that he got this degree from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service in National Security Studies, or that he served as the chief of this the special assistant to the chief of naval operations. Those, along with his other degrees, seem like they qualify him greatly to be on the National Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
So I have not heard that. I did not hear that on point, nor did I hear your guest mention that.
Okay. Scott, what do you know about that?
Well, she's absolutely right, and that is in the profile that I wrote of him in December. He was a young naval officer. He served on a ship for a couple years, and then he went to the Pentagon, where he had this sort of staff job with the chief of naval operations. But he was, you know, he was a young guy. He was basically just out of college when he joined the Navy. So this was 30 years ago. He went from the Pentagon, that job that he had at the Pentagon, to Harvard Business School and sort of began his career after that. So he certainly does not have the kind of resume that is usually associated with people on the National Security Council, you know, or at the top of the sort of national security part of the government. But it's absolutely right that he spent several years in the Navy and I believe about a year or so in the Pentagon as a young man, you know, many years ago.
And let's go next to Anna Lisa in Green Bay. Hi, Anna Lisa.
Hi. Well, my question is, why are we only hearing about all of this now, about his extreme views and his significant influence on Donald Trump? I mean, he was appointed chairman of Donald Trump's campaign, I believe, in August or September.
Right.
Certainly people in the press knew about him and his work at Breitbart and the kinds of views that they were pushing at, there. And I don't recall, I mean, I think I'm a fairly tuned-in observer, but I don't recall any specials about Steve Bannon. I don't recall any long articles. Of course, your article in the New York Times was in November. But I think we needed to know about this man a lot sooner. And
yeah, I know people have written about him. It's certainly been reported on quite a bit in the New York Times and other papers as well. Maybe we read about it more and are writing about it more now because of the position that he has in the government. It would appear that his views are really giving priority by the President of the United States, which elevates where he is. Scott, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, he got a lot of attention in August when he, you know, took over as CEO of the Trump campaign. Some people would say he rescued the Trump campaign. A lot of people would say that Trump would not be president if Bannon hadn't stepped in and taken that job at that time. And he did get a lot of attention. If you go to the New York Times site, nytimes.com, and put Steve Bannon's name into the search engine, you'll find lots and lots of stories, including some front-page stories before that long profile that I wrote in late November. But I think it's inevitable. You know, when he was appointed, he was taking over what appeared to be a losing presidential campaign. Then after Trump won, obviously, there was greater focus on him, and that's when we did that long profile. And then, you know, now he's in the White House, and, you know, you never know how things are going to turn out, but certainly in these first couple weeks, he's emerged as perhaps the central figure in shaping a lot of what's going on there. So he's of even greater interest now by virtue of his position. But he certainly was not ignored in the months after he joined the campaign.
Suzanne in Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate you doing this story on Bannon because I think he's a very dangerous man. And as a Jewish American, I am very concerned about him having Trump's ear. On National Holocaust Day, they did not mention the Jews. I think that was deliberate. And I'm very concerned about him being in the Situation Room. I think he has absolutely no place there. And I'm very concerned about that. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks, Suzanne. Scott, you want to comment?
Well, as I said previously, I don't have any evidence. I couldn't find any evidence that he is personally anti-Semitic. He certainly tolerated anti-Semitic views at times, you know, around and on Breitbart, on the Breitbart News site. I think a lot of folks that, you know, follow this closely would say that he's expressed far more negative views of Muslims and of Islam than of Jews and Judaism. And he often talks about the Judeo-Christian West as what he wants to defend. So I think in some ways it's Muslims who would have the most concerns about him.
Kurt in Waukesha, hi.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to bring up, I think people are tired of the politics of everything, and we should just stick to the pragmaticism of what everybody wants, and that is we have to know your contribution factor to society and your fellow man. Do you pay taxes? And the accountants that are in charge of, like, let's say the Fortune 100 companies, if every employee you divide, it contributes $50,000 in profits for the Fortune 100 companies, and this is known to be a fact, I believe, where is the money divvied up?
Yeah, I'm not sure what you're getting at. How does this relate to Steve Bannon, Kurt?
Well, I think they're trying to stick to the pragmatism of, you know, getting the jobs, everybody working, everybody...
Right, okay, I got your point. And the populist part of this, we haven't heard a whole lot yet about massive infrastructure, et cetera, but I would imagine if the administration moves fairly quickly on that front, they will make a lot of their supporters and probably some other Americans rather happy, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, actually, Bannon gave an interview after the election in which he, I believe I'm quoting him correctly, said he was going to drive the Republicans crazy with an infrastructure plan, with a big infrastructure plan. You know, what he would mean by that, presumably, is that the deficit hawks in the Republican Party who want to cut back on government spending will not be happy if President Trump proposes, you know, billions and billions of dollars on infrastructure spending. And, you know, quite typically, Bannon seemed thrilled with the idea of driving the Republicans crazy, you know, let alone the Democrats.
And one more call for you, then, same topic. We're just switching guests. Let's go to Bruce in Madison. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I was a little bit frustrated, like one of the other callers, because it sounds like your guest is almost bordering on an apology for Bannon's, you know, negativity about Muslims. If the guy's a bigot, he doesn't have to be a bigot against everybody, so he's a bigot, and that's just it. I think everybody ought to keep their eye on the Constitution, and if it violates any part of the Constitution, that's where everybody should get up in arms and fight.
Are you aware of how many lawsuits there are now against that executive order? Scott?
There are a bunch, and of course judges have ruled, you know, on an emergency basis already on Saturday night, you know, to put a hold on some aspects of it. I certainly don't mean to defend or apologize for Steve Bannon's you know, hostility to Muslims. In fact, in later today or tomorrow, there will be a I've done a kind of analysis commentary on a talk that Bannon gave in 2014, where he talks extensively about the threat from Muslims and radical Islam that the caller might find of interest.
Mm-hmm. And we will as well. Scott, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Scott Shane, New York Times, has been covering national security and terrorism for a number of years. He's also the author of a new book, Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone, which largely focuses on Anwar Awlaki. And he has done this profile, which is on our Facebook page and worth a read. It's well done, the Kathleen Dunn Show. We are going to continue talking about Steve Bannon, and our next guest has written a piece saying Steve Bannon is making sure there's no White House paper trail. She has written a lengthy piece about his appointment to the Principals Committee at the National Security Council and how this whole decision about refugees came into being. She says, and many people are reporting this, that it was largely a Steve Bannon decision and that others didn't have much input at the table, and there's no paper trail, really, of how decisions were made. So we'll talk with Kate Brannon in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about Steve Bannon's growing influence inside the White House.
I think anger is a good thing. I think if you're fighting, this country's in a crisis.
The 63-year-old former banker also headed the far-right Breitbart News website and is known for quotes like, "Darkness is good," and "Dick Cheney, Darth Vader, Satan, that's power."
We're now, I believe, at the beginning stages of a global war against Islamic fascism.
And in a 2010 radio interview discovered by CNN's K-File.
Islam is not a religion of peace. Islam is a religion of submission.
He understands and fights for the working class Americans out there who haven't had their voices heard.
Kate Brannon is our guest now. She's the deputy managing editor of Just Security, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. She was a senior reporter covering the Pentagon for foreign policy and also a defense reporter for Politico. And she has written a piece, I gave the title, Steve Bannon, Making Sure There's No White House Paper Trail. Your phone call is still good for this part of the show, so just stay where you are, and I promise you we'll get to you very soon. Kate, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Your piece was very interesting. What's happening, let's talk about all these decisions that have been made recently. You write in your piece that many of these executive orders have been taking place outside the normal construct, and it would appear to me from reading the article very much outside the normal construct. What is the normal construct? Why is it set up the way that it is? And how is, and what kind of decision-making is happening? How is it happening now?
So my piece really focused on what it was like for the first week of work for the National Security Council staff under the new Trump administration. And the information I received over the weekend was from somebody who went into, you know, that first week with an open mind, ready to serve the new president, and by the end was in, you know, almost a state of shock about how things were run, confirmed that Bannon is very much in charge behind the scenes, and said the normal construct is the National Security Council staff and the Deputies Committee, they generate options. The whole purpose of the National Security Council is to develop advice for the president so that he can make decisions with the range of options and the range of opinions presented to him. And the way that's done is through meetings that are well documented. There's a summary of conclusions called a SOC that comes out of those. That captures everybody's opinion, and then that works its way up through the Principals Committee and eventually to the president. And this person described last week that there was basically no paper being generated by the National Security Council staff, meaning whatever meetings there were happening, it wasn't clear to him who was sort of writing what happened during them and who was documenting what happened during them and who was writing down the difference of opinions. And at the beginning of the week, as these draft executive orders started to come out internally, staff went into it sort of with the normal way of doing things, but the previous way of doing things, and that doesn't just mean under Obama, but also under President Bush, to sort of shop them around to get, you know, whoever had a stake in whatever the executive order was, to get them to weigh in. And as this reached its way up to Bannon and his staff, they got very upset about this, thinking, you know, this has nothing to do with other people. They shouldn't be weighing in. And by the end of the week, the routing system for those executive orders had become much smaller and fewer people had a chance to look at them.
Mm. And this is because it's a new administration and they don't know how things are done and the reason for doing things a certain way? Or is it just this is the way you think things are going to be done down the road?
I think it's still too early to tell if it's deliberate or if we should give them the benefit of the doubt and they're going through growing pains. One thing that they didn't have last week was an organizational chart, meaning who has what portfolio still, like who's still working on Iran and who does Iran report to? Does it report to Flynn? And by Flynn I mean Lieutenant General Flynn, who's the National Security Advisor. Does it go to Bannon? And that's something that people from previous administrations, both Democrat and Republican, said you have that like weeks before you go into office. You don't start on day one without knowing how that's going to work, because it's not reliant on anybody other than, you know, the Trump team to come up with that. So that seemed very unusual. There were a few signs early this week that they're kind of trying to clean things up a bit. They had, I've been told yesterday they finally had their first all-hands meeting, which, you know, is definitely later than usual, but that they were told not to bring their cell phones, and that this is very unusual. This isn't a classified meeting. If it were, it would be happening in what's called a SCIF, but it wasn't one of those. And so to the people I've talked to, they say this shows a certain level of distrust on the part of the Trump people for the National Security Council staff. So that's kind of disconcerting.
Mm-hmm.
And then Flynn also sent a memo on Monday, sort of the memo that my source was waiting for, which was basically like, we're here, we want to say hello to you, we want to work with you. And one of the things he said in it was, we're going to have a discipline process that will be of the highest standards. So it's possible that they are still implementing the way they want to do things, and we might start seeing some kind of paper trail out of their meetings, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So tell me exactly how this would have happened. The executive order with the refugee ban and targeting all these Muslims from seven countries, this would have gone to the National Security Council, where Steve Bannon now has a seat on the principals table, and they would have talked about it, and then it went back to the president, or what happened here?
Well, it's not unusual for presidents to come in and, you know, issue a bunch of executive orders, you know, start with the initiatives that they had in mind. I think something of this scale with so many legal implications, it would have had broader buy-in. It would have had a legal review, which it doesn't seem to have had, or at least not thoroughly enough. I mean, it already is facing a lot of legal challenges.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the National Security Council staff, and this I just saw as I was, waiting to get on the phone, but sort of a new example of what's going on. Flynn just had a briefing at the White House with reporters where he said, we are officially putting Iran on notice.
I saw that, yeah.
Left people scratching their heads, sort of, what on earth does that mean? And I've already been told that he will brief the National Security Council staff later this afternoon about what he meant. And that's kind of the exact reversal of how this would normally go. You would have an expert group help inform whatever decision you're going to take, and then with that, you would then make your announcement versus make your announcement and then run it by the experts that you have, who you have there to do that very thing.
Right. Well, it makes people a little fearful, too, doesn't it, to have Flynn come up and at the podium and say we're putting Iran on notice, and you as a reporter in these areas don't know exactly what he's talking about. It's kind of puts things in upheaval, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's, I don't know what that means. And I think it's part and parcel of what we've been seeing, you know, since they took office. It's chaotic, and I think that it's intended to be.
Mm. So you have this, and I'm still wondering, you would know this certainly better than I would, how this order, going back to last weekend and the incredible chaos and hardship it caused for so many people at airports and in foreign countries, and all of these diplomats who have signed letters of dissent, and how this was handled, that the people who needed to implement this radical change weren't informed until the executive order was being signed. Does Steve Bannon have anything to do with that? Was it just the president getting this out and not thinking about the ramifications? I'm just wondering how this could happen without a lot of people knowing about it and sitting around a table and at some length talking about the advisability of this.
Yes, I think, I think a lot of people see it, I mean, as a tool to centralize power, you know, to make the group that decides a lot smaller than it used to be. It gives that person a lot more power and a lot more authority. One big question is at the Department of Homeland Security, which largely has to implement this executive order, is what did General Kelly know and when did he know it? There was an early report that it took him by surprise, that he was being briefed on it in the moment the president was signing it. And then yesterday he came out and tried to clarify the record, and he said he had reviewed two drafts of it. But to me, that left open the possibility that he didn't actually see the final draft. And I think that's a big question. I know I've seen reporting, too, that General Mattis at the Pentagon was particularly incensed by it. That was reporting done by the AP. So, and it's not clear, you know, was the blowback strong enough that this might not be how they do things the next time around, or is this the new normal?
Yeah. Well, and you write, when some officials saw the draft executive orders, they felt they had broad impact and shared them more widely for staffing and comments, which didn't sit well with Steve Bannon or with his staff. So it seems to me as though there's going to be kind of a showdown with Steve Bannon and his staff, or Steve Bannon is going to have to step back a little bit. Do you know which way we're going to be going?
I don't, but I would imagine that if Trump doesn't want to, you know, have some high-level cabinet resignations, it will have to be more of a balance.
Mm.
Because I don't think, whether it's General Kelly or General Mattis or Rex Tillerson at State, I mean, they don't want to be made to look like fools, and I don't think they'll put up with it. So I imagine there'll be pushback internally, and that some equilibrium will be reached. Whether it's the right equilibrium, I don't know yet.
We'll start taking phone calls for Kate in a moment. Kate Brannon is Deputy Managing Editor of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. She has written for the Daily Beast, Foreign Policy, was a senior reporter covering the Pentagon for Foreign Policy. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. We'll take more phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls for Kate, and we start with Katie in Janesville. Hi, Katie. Katie, are you there? I'll call us back. Lester in Madison. Hi, Lester.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two questions. One is, does your guest think that the chaos that's been rampant in the administration's release of policy statements and executive orders is, in a way, to deliberately flush out people who might not be loyal and follow orders? And the other is, what is the role of the other Steve, Stephen Miller? I've read that he actually was working on the travel ban for months before the inauguration. And that's all. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Lester.
Two great questions. On the loyalty one, I think that could absolutely be true. I've heard, you know, the day after the inauguration, Sean Spicer, the press secretary, came out and made the false claim that it was the largest inauguration ever. And a lot of people on the inside and outside saw that as a loyalty test. You know, are you going to go out and say what we want you to say and take the fall for us? So I've heard that, you know, that's a big part of it, and that there's very little appetite for dissent, especially from Bannon. And on the Miller question, I went back to look at, because there's a lot of indications that he also is, you know, very influential behind the scenes. He is a former staffer for Jeff Sessions, Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama, and that he and Bannon go as far back as, I think it's the 2008 immigration bill, which Bannon was at Breitbart at the time, and Miller was on Sessions' staff, and together they worked to help defeat that bill through sort of Miller feeding information to Bannon, which he could then use on Breitbart, and sort of whip up opposition to it. So I thought that was fascinating, and that these two are very used to working together.
Is it highly unusual to have somebody, going back to Bannon, as influential as he appears to be, to have really have the president's ear and to be fashioning so much policy?
I don't think that piece is that unusual. I mean, if you look at the Obama administration, David Axelrod or Valerie Jarrett or John Podesta all fill similar roles in terms of they're his political counselors, and they were clearly, you know, some of the strongest voices at the table, I would argue. Same for Karl Rove under George W. Bush. So, I mean, I think it's always the political, and that's why people got nervous when Trump named Bannon to be his chief strategist, because it meant that, you know, he was absolutely going to have a central role in this administration.
Mm-hmm. Lester, thanks for your call. John and Shano. Hi, John.
Oh, hi, guys. I barely had a chance to collect my thoughts. I was snow blowing from yesterday up here in beautiful Shawnee. number one, it's our president these days, it is the corporate states of America, it seems to be. Nothing's really going to be trickling down. And every single appointee seems to be a billionaire. Could you please give me a comment on that? It is not going to be. Hello?
Yeah, we're here. All right, we got the gist of what you want to talk about. You want to respond, Kate?
Well, I was just thinking about this morning as I was reading up on Bannon's background, and, you know, a core part of him is being anti-establishment. And in a way, and so then to name all these billionaires and bankers to the administration, I find confounding. And I'm afraid I'm not going to be helpful because I don't have an answer as to why, but they seem to be contradictory.
I'm wondering how much, what the word is around Washington concerning Bannon. I have read today that one Bannon quote that's making the rounds and was making the rounds over the weekend is this: Lenin wanted to destroy the state, and that's my goal, too. I want to bring everything crashing down and destroy all of today's establishment.
Yeah, that was a chilling one. From the people I've talked to, there's just a big question. What is this all driving towards? Sort of what is Bannon's endgame here? And is that a quote to inform the answer, or is it something else? Because whether it's, you know, provoking a trade war with Mexico or weakening NATO and emboldening Russia, whatever the issue is, some of this stuff appears to be destructive and appears to be counter U.S. interests. So what, you know, what's the end game? And I don't think people know, but people are worried.
Mm-hmm. And what about the response? We have read about these number of diplomats really all over the world now who have signed dissent notice over the immigration changes, the executive order. What are you hearing about that? Is it an unprecedented number of people? Who are these people who are saying this could create many more problems than what you're trying to fix?
Yeah, the thing that's astonished me is how many sort of battles they're fighting on how many different fronts. I mean, with whether it's with the Justice Department or with the immigrant fight, or it's with your own Foreign Service staff. And Foreign Service staff are, you know, they're supposed to, they are used to serving under different political administrations. I mean, that's what they do. And so to say, if you're not with us, you can just quit, it gives the impression that you don't think you need all of the usual things in place to run the government. And it feeds into this, you know, the other story, which is sort of centralizing decision-making and centralizing power and making it a much smaller group of people who are, you know, really making decisions in Washington. And that may be what people voted for when they voted for Donald Trump. But I think for others who've served under different administrations, Republican, Democrat, I mean, it seems crazy to alienate the intelligence community and alienate your Foreign Service Corps. And, you know, these are things that you really, I think experts would say, and seasoned politicians, not even politicians, but just, you know, people who've been in Washington would say, you need these things in order to do your job.
Mm-hmm. So what are you looking at today? You probably have so much to look at. You would be up for days and days, never sleep this week, right, to figure some of this out, Kate.
It comes, I mean, the news obviously is coming fast and furious. I probably will hang up the phone and go and see exactly what Flynn said,
right,
about Iran and what that signals. I think that's maybe the new leading story of the news cycle, I guess.
I guess you're right. We'll have to figure that out. But it said without very much background on it, and it's said by one person, and again, it makes you wonder, where was all the deliberative discussion about all of this? Did people sit around a table and talk about Iran, or where did this come from? Who knows?
Yeah, we'll find out.
Thank you. We'll read what you write. Kate, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Kate Brennan. Kate is deputy managing editor of Just Security. She's a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security. She wrote a very interesting piece on Steve Bannon, making sure, she says, there is no White House paper trail, according to an intelligence source. The Trump administration's chief strategist has already taken control for both policy and process on national security. If there was any question about who's largely in charge of national security behind the scenes at the White House, the answer is becoming increasingly clear. It is Stephen Bannon, the former head of Breitbart News. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee for your calls. Thank you. Go to our Facebook page to read the articles if you want more information on all that we've been talking about, because there you will find a lot more information. News is coming up. We'll return